My guest, Jhumpa Lahiri, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2000 for her first book, the collection of short stories Interpreter of Maladies. Her first novel, The Namesake, has just been published, and like her short stories, it's about the lives of immigrants and their children. A young couple, Ashma and Ashok Ganguly, has emigrated from Calcutta to Massachusetts, where they have a son whom they name Gogol. In a New York Times book review of The Namesake, critic Michiko Kakutani wrote, "It is a novel about two generations of the Ganguly family, and at the same time, it is a novel about exile and its discontents, a novel that is as affecting in its Chekhovian exploration of fathers and sons, parents and children, as it is resonant in its exploration of what is acquired and lost by immigrants and their children in pursuit of the American dream." Jhumpa Lahiri is the daughter of immigrants from Calcutta. She was born in London in 1967 and grew up in Rhode Island. She now lives in Brooklyn. Let's start with a reading from The Namesake from the first chapter, which is set in 1968, a year and a half after Ashma Ganguly has moved to America. She's in the hospital, about to give birth to her son.
Dr. Ashley pokes in his head from time to time. "No need to worry," he chirps, putting a stethoscope to Ashima's belly, patting her hand, admiring her various bracelets. "Everything is looking perfectly normal. We are expecting a perfectly normal delivery, Mrs. Ganguly." But nothing feels normal to Ashima. For the past 18 months, ever since she's arrived in Cambridge, nothing has felt normal at all. It's not so much the pain, which she knows, somehow, she will survive. It's the consequence, motherhood in a foreign land. For it was one thing to be pregnant, to suffer the queasy mornings in bed, the sleepless nights, the dull throbbing in her back, the countless visits to the bathroom. Throughout the experience, in spite of her growing discomfort, she'd been astonished by her body's ability to make life, exactly as her mother and grandmother and all her great-grandmothers had done. That it was happening so far from home, unmonitored and unobserved by those she loved, had made it more miraculous still. But she is terrified to raise a child in a country where she is related to no one, where she knows so little, where life seems so tentative and spare.
That's Jhumpa Lahiri reading from her new novel, The Namesake. I want to ask you about a phrase in there. She's worried about having this baby unmonitored and unobserved by those she loved. And I'm wondering what made you think of being unobserved by those she loved.
Well, I think I was just thinking about, you know, when we go through traumatic, dramatic changes in life, be they good or bad, to have to be isolated while those things are happening, I think makes them somehow unreal in a way. And so I think that what Ashima is feeling here is that she needs to be acknowledged, her life, her pregnancy, all of this needs to be acknowledged somehow by people she really knows and trusts rather than the people in America whom she doesn't know and doesn't trust.
It's as if it needs to be witnessed by the people she really loves,
exactly.
The people she really connects to, and they're not there to witness this. So,
yes, and
it's
I
not,
think that,
it's not a full experience.
Yes, exactly.
Names are very important in your book, and one of the main characters is the son of a couple who was from India. And the son is named Gogol. He doesn't really understand why he has that name. All he knows is it's really weird and kind of embarrassing, like when he's in school and they start reading Gogol, and his name is Gogol. He's not really proud of it. He's just kind of confused and kind of embarrassed. Gogol was his pet name. There was a tradition in this family that the grandmother would name all the children, but the grandmother is far away, and a letter with the name never arrives. But the parents have given the son a pet name. What is the pet name in the Bengali tradition?
The pet name is essentially the name that is used at home and by family and by friends and by people who with whom you're very close, but really stemming from the family. The pet name is what your parents call you, what your grandparents call you, what your siblings would call you, your older siblings. If they're younger, they don't call you by name because there's a separate tradition of having to address your elders by specific terms and never by name.
And it's only for people who know you really well. Other people probably don't even know what that name is.
Yes, and what happens, what usually ends up happening, what I've observed is that as soon as the child goes to school, he or she is enrolled under the formal name, the proper name, the good name. And as a result, you can have very close friends, you know, made after the age of, say, 5 or 6, who will call you by your good name. And many times I've observed that, you know, I may have, you know, aunts and uncles who met each other in, say, college or high school and subsequently got married, and they will call each other by their good name. So really the pet name at its heart is a reference to childhood, to those very earliest years of your life when you are in the fold of, very firmly within the fold of a family. And taken care of, and all of those things that are implicit in being very young and not having an independence and identity, a separate identity from your family.
Could you tell us what your pet name was?
My pet name is Jhumpa, and it, my good name never took hold. I actually have two other names that were supposed to be my... Well, one of them was supposed to end up being my public name, my name in the world. But what happened in real life is sort of similar to what happens to my character, Gogol, which is that when I was enrolled in school, I think it was kindergarten, and my parents took me to school and said, here's our daughter, her name is Nilanjana, which is the first of my good names on my birth certificate and on my passport. And the teacher must have looked a bit overwhelmed by the name and I think asked something along the lines of, do you have anything shorter? And my parents said, well, we also call her Jhumpa. And she decided that was the better option. And I don't think my parents realized at the time that this would really stick so firmly and that my good name never really had a chance. And so as a result, I've been Jhumpa in public and in private all my life. And it's been remarked upon by many of my Indian relatives that this is somehow inappropriate. And many people, after I published my book, you know, many people sort of said, you know, why are you published under that name? That's not the name you're supposed to publish books under. You know, that's just a pet name. So it's very funny to me.
The son in your novel, Gogol, is given that name because his father was reading a book by Gogol when his father was saved from a train wreck. And it was, in fact, a page from the book that was seen by the rescuers. And if he hadn't been reading that book, the rescuers wouldn't have known he was there and wouldn't have been able to save his life. But Gogol doesn't know that. Why wouldn't the father tell Gogol the story behind his name?
I think the reason the father withholds that information about how he was rescued from this train wreck may have something to do with the fact that once the father goes to America, he wants to put that accident, the memory of that night behind him in a way and doesn't really want to, I don't know, I imagine that he sort of compartmentalized his life in terms of before the accident and after the accident. And I think geographically that, you know, manifests itself as life in India versus life in the United States. I think also it probably has to do with a more general kind of estrangement that the father feels toward his son in terms of how different they are, how different their life experiences have been and will be, and just a sort of distance that exists between them emotionally.
Is this something that you feel a lot of children of immigrants have faced, that they are defining experiences that their parents have had, that their parents feel are like from another world or another part of their life or somehow kind of inexplicable and untranslatable for their children, and therefore it increases the gap. It increases the cultural divide because these key things aren't translated for the children.
I think so. I think you put that very, very well. I think there's a sense that once you're in the new world, you're just working so hard to survive in the present and move toward the future in a way that there isn't even energy or time to dwell on that past in a way. And I think for me, at least, observing my parents, I just saw them in the moment. I just saw them as foreigners living in New England, struggling, having accents, you know, being bewildered by things. And their lives in India were so remote, and there was so little for them to connect with, you know, in terms of their past. You know, that it was just these letters, half of which got lost in the mail, and, you know, the occasional phone call and the occasional visit. And, you know, I think the world has really changed so much in the time that I've been alive. I think it is different for immigrants now in many ways. I mean, the world has sort of grown smaller, and communication is so much more available in so many different ways and improved. But I felt, you know, when I was growing up in the 70s, I really felt that my parents, I felt that India was just another planet. It was just another world.
Could you speak their language, or were you only able to communicate with them in English?
No, Bengali was my first language, literally. I didn't speak any English until I went to school. And so I always knew how to speak with them in Bengali, and I continue to speak with them in Bengali.
You grew up thinking of your parents as the foreigners, the people struggling with English, the people who didn't understand American customs. What was it like for you when you went with them to India and saw them in their own culture, knowing that you were the foreigner there?
Well, I both was and wasn't the foreigner, which made it interesting. I was technically, I had been raised in another part of the world and knew things that, for example, my relatives in India didn't know. But on the other hand, I did feel a sense of belonging that I didn't feel in the United States, but it was all very, you know, it was very mixed. It was never one thing. And similarly, I think over the years, I saw my parents returning to a place where they ostensibly belonged, where they had family, where they had, you know, all of these memories and connections and a sense of place. But over the years, I felt that all of those things were attenuated, and that they too felt like foreigners. And so I never saw anything as being one, strictly one thing or the other. And I think that going there taught me a lot about, you know, the position of a person who leaves one's native country. My parents always put it as, they always feel like they have a foot in two separate boats on the water, and each of the boats is floating and wanting to sort of go in its own direction, and you're sort of stuck in between, not knowing which to go into.
In your book, the son, Gogol, never sees his parents display any physical affection. What was your understanding of love and marriage from watching your parents?
My parents had an arranged marriage, and so I was aware that this tradition existed in the world. Most of their relatives have had similarly arranged marriages. And I felt a combination, I think, growing up. I felt a combination of both bewilderment that, you know, two strangers could suddenly find themselves married as a result of an afternoon's meeting or decision by their parents or what have you. But I also felt very protective of them, because I felt that, you know, that their marriage and also, you know, all of these other marriages that I knew of was regarded with, you know, as a sort of bizarre, primitive, tradition that that was backward somehow in the eyes of, say, my American friends or, you know, acquaintances in school, you know. So I really felt both things. Even as a young child, I was always hesitant to, you know, accept one way and reject the other way.
Yeah, your first book, a collection of short stories called Interpreter of Maladies, won a Pulitzer Prize. Did winning a big prize like this for your first book make it any easier or more difficult to write your second book?
It certainly didn't make it easier, because nothing makes writing easy for me. I can't imagine anything that could make it easy. I wish there were something, but unfortunately, I don't think that thing exists. I've tried to do is really sort of associate that all of the attention that was brought to me because of the Pulitzer, I sort of associated it very firmly with Interpreter of Maladies. And by the time I had won the prize, I was already working on the namesake, and Interpreter of Maladies was very much a part of my past, And I just sort of thought, well, this is one prize that belongs to one book that I'm going to write. And, you know, my goal is to write, you know, to create a body of work and to keep writing books. And, you know, some will win prizes, I guess. One of them has won a prize. I don't assume they all will.
Do you consider writing to be very difficult?
Extremely difficult, yes.
Do you enjoy it? I realize enjoy when you're talking about work isn't enjoy like when you're talking about sitting at the beach, but I mean, mm-hmm. I guess...
I enjoy the challenge, yes. I enjoy the challenge of it, but I don't, you know, it's not sitting at the beach. I don't have a good time while I'm working at it. It's very difficult, just in a basic way, just in terms of writing the sentences and being satisfied with them on any level is very hard. And it's also hard to, you know, the sort of psychological aspect of it, the thinking about things, imagining things, confronting your fears, your pain in your life and the lives of other people. That's also very difficult for me.
So this kind of comes down to why do it? Why write? What compels you to do it?
It's not really a choice for me. I never thought that way about writing. I never thought to myself, people sometimes say, when did you decide you wanted to be a writer? There was no moment of decision. I started writing as soon as I could start to read. It just felt like, it's like someone asking me, why do you read? You know, I read to understand life. I write to understand life. You know, I can't explain it in any other way. I only know that if I don't write, I don't feel like I'm living fully and that I'm not understanding life as best as I can. And I also feel, I just don't feel right. I feel quite miserable, actually, if I'm not at least trying to write. So that's why I do it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Jhumpa Lahiri's new novel is called The Namesake.